This information is designed to provide accurate and authoritative information with regard to the subject matter covered. It is offered with the understanding that the presenters are not engaged in rendering legal, accounting, or other professional services. If legal advice or other expert advice is required, the services of a competent professional should be sought.
Well, good evening and welcome, everyone. This is James Orr, and it is just before 6 o'clock. And since Brian is not coming, unless he may be coming later, but I don't think he's coming early, I will get started with my philosophy of if you're not early, you're late. So it's now 6 o'clock or very close to it. So we're going to get started. This is Northern Colorado, quarter three, 2020, real estate market stats. I'm James Orr, your host, real estate broker. Couple upcoming classes. We're going to go over those before we get started tonight. Hey, if you guys can let me know, because Brian's not on tonight, if you guys can let me know if you can hear me, that'd be awesome. Go ahead and just put it in the chat window or something like that, or raise your hand or whatever the equivalent is for you. Awesome. Skylar can hear me. So perfect. Thank you. Thank you very much. So upcoming classes. So next week on Wednesday, in honor of Veterans Day, thank you for your service for all those that have served as a veteran. We are going to do a mini class on the ultimate guide to VA financing. VA is Veterans Administration, and those are VA loans, a nothing down loan program. There are other nothing down loan programs as well, but that week we're going to go over November 11th. We're going to go over special VA financing mini class. I'll try to cover everything related to the VA loan that I possibly can, and we will go and cover that class. It is intended to be a mini class, so I don't know if it'll go full 2 hours. I don't think it will. I think it'll be a relatively short one. But we'll do that. And then the week after that, the ultimate guide to market corrections. And I still do not know what I'm going to be teaching you there. I will tell you that I think about market corrections a lot. I think about stock market corrections. I think about real estate market corrections. What happens if rents go down? What happens if property prices go down? What happens if we're investing while a market is declining? Or what if we have our full portfolio and the markets decline? And so I will talk to you about how I think about those, how I model those, what it looks like if we have market stuff. It's basically going to be everything about market corrections that I could possibly think of and get out in one class. And that will be on November 18th. That will probably be 2 hours. I probably could do a full day on that one, honestly. So I'll have to try to figure out what I'm going to put in there and where to start and stop. So after that, happy Thanksgiving to everyone. Hopefully we're not going to create a whole bunch of super spreader events. My mother actually decided not to come visit me here in Northern Colorado because of COVID stuff. She said, hey, listen, you know, if it's all right, I think we're not going to travel. I said, yeah, that's probably a good idea, actually, since you're like high 70s and probably higher risk. So they are not going to travel for Thanksgiving. And so it'll be a very lonely Thanksgiving. In fact, this may be the first Thanksgiving. I'm trying to think about this. This may literally be the first Thanksgiving I haven't spent with my parents. It's be interesting. So anyway, Thanksgiving. Happy Thanksgiving to all of you. Hopefully you have some things to be grateful for and thankful for. Then the long-awaited class. Are they on tonight? I had some clients very specifically request that I put this on the calendar. If they're on, go ahead and just put their name in a chat window. I don't see them. I'm scanning through. I don't quickly see them on here. But anyway, Nomad by Proxy. How to do Nomad without actually moving into the properties yourself. So if you've ever wanted, you're like, hey, this Nomad thing sounds amazing, but there's no freaking way I'm going to get my spouse to move into these properties every year. I'll do it. I hear this all the time. I'll do it, but I don't think my husband or my wife's going to go for that. You know, just the idea of moving all the time, not going to happen. Well, I got good news for you. There's a whole strategy on how to do nomading where you have someone else nomad on your behalf. Yeah, Nathan's excited for that class. Yep, exactly. So we're going to go over that class. Haven't started writing it yet. I have a feeling it's going to be amazing. And that will be on December 2nd. Merry Christmas to all. And to all, Merry Christmas. That is my Christmas gift to you. And then if that wasn't good enough, apparently I am teaching reducing risk while nomading. Another finally, James got around to creating a class on how to reduce risk as a nomad. And so I will tell you all about my ideas on reducing risk and all the things you can do in order to make it less risky and mitigate risk and do risk management. It'll pick up where the warning, or what's it called? warning the danger and risks of real estate investing. I did a whole 2-hour class on like every possible risk and danger you could possibly have investing in real estate. And I spend a whole bunch of time talking about what the risk is, how to mitigate it, whether we're really exposed to it, how exposed are we, whole bunch of stuff in that. I haven't taught that class in a long time, a few years ago. And that actually will be, I'll pick up where I left off and I will specifically talk about this for Nomads. Although, I mean, really, it applies to a lot of people. It applies to people that are doing traditional 20% down buy and hold or buying property subject to creatively, all that other stuff too. It really does apply to everybody, but I will actually teach it to Nomads. I'll teach it around the Nomad strategy. And there are some things that are unique to Nomads that you want to learn about. So I don't know if anyone's excited about that, but that has been a long requested class as well. Reducing risk while nomading. I'm just like, you know, maybe I'm like coming to the end of my life because I'm just getting all the things that have been on my list. And I'm like, yeah, I'll eventually do that. Kind of put it on my list of things to do. For some reason, I just put them on the calendar and I'm like, all right, we're going to get these done. So I hope you guys are happy with that. If you're not happy with that, might I suggest very politely and kindly and sincerely that you go to realestatefinancialplanner.com/suggest. And tell me what you really think. Tell me what classes you would really like on there. And maybe I'll go and who knows? Maybe I'll just cross everything off the list and get whatever you guys want on there done. So we do have a ton of classes already. And so if we're missing something, please do go on there and suggest a class. And I will seriously consider teaching that class. Or I will tell you why I'm not teaching that class. Like I've had people ask me for things that I'm just not qualified to teach. I'm just like, you know, this is the circle of my competence. That's like out here. I'm like nowhere near that thing. Steve says Broncos winning season should be on that list. Yeah, I agree. They had a good game, right? I mean, it's kind of eked it by, but I don't know. I signed up for the NFL game pass where I could watch football games in 45 minutes. They basically do all the fast forwarding for you and remove all the commercials and everything. And so I treated myself to that, I think last weekend or the weekend before. And so now I can watch like six football games. I've got this list of teams now that I'm following. Anyway, that's all, totally off topic. realestatefinancialplanner.com/suggest. You can go ahead and suggest any classes that you want to see. All right. Introductions via chat. If you would please right now, switch the chat window to say all panelists and attendees. That way other people can see your message. And if for some reason I miss your message, especially since Brian is not, I'll ask some of the more kinder folks to help me manage those tonight and remind me if I miss somebody's question or I need to answer something. But if you do all panelists and attendees, and then who are you and where are you from? My thought is that we would see a much higher concentration of Northern Colorado people. If you haven't noticed, we've had a lot of people from around the country on for the other classes. But now this one, since it's Northern Colorado, Q3 2020 real estate market stats, I would think we'd have more people from Northern Colorado on here. So if you guys would be willing to let me know where you're from, that'd be great. And then what is your favorite real estate market stat and why? If you guys would be willing to share what your favorite real estate market stat is and why. I did not prepare, I don't know, 90% of this presentation tonight. If you've been to my previous market stats classes, I have done classes where I go create all the stats. I'll go and, you know, analyze the data and create all the charts and everything like that. I joined a different real estate brokerage. We joined Your Castle Real Estate Brokerage out of Denver, and they actually produce their own market stats. And so I happen to be able to just use their existing PowerPoint slide deck in order to show you the market stats. So I will be sharing with you their market stats. And in addition to that, once that's done, I have probably another dozen to two dozen charts from the news of some really interesting real estate related charts about market stats, things that they did not include in there. So there's some pretty amazing things in there too. So yeah, that's about all I got for you. So if you got questions as we go through market stats, please do use the chat window and let me know what your questions are. I'm going to take it a little bit slower than I usually do because I have not a 300 slide presentation to do. And so I should be able to answer questions. Also, I will try to record this. It's recording now. I'll try to post it up. And if you need to watch the video again, hopefully, knock on wood, technology will cooperate. I'll get the video up. And in addition to that, the PDF of the slides that Your Castle presented, those are available on the market stats page on the website, along with a gazillion other market stats things. In fact, I probably should show you all the crazy stuff that's on there. And why don't I do that right now? Actually, it's just to be awkward because I have my email open and stuff like that. But if you go to realestatefinancialplanner.com/market-stats, there is a mother load of market stats there. Everything from entire presentations on fix and flip properties to the luxury market to maps of price changes by geographical area to this presentation will be up there after this presentation is done. I didn't put it up there ahead of time. And a whole bunch of other stuff. So there's like a ridiculous amount on there. And in fact, if I'll type it in here, and if for some reason the link doesn't work, you guys can tell me. Yeah. So Gabe says, what was the web address? So I just typed it in there. If someone wants to, click on that and tell me if that does work for you, that would be great. And then if it doesn't work for you, we'll figure it out. Okay, cool. So if you guys have questions, go ahead and let me know and we'll do that. There is a podcast. I uploaded a bunch of the real estate investor stories, which apparently are like super popular. People really love those. Gabe says it works. Okay, perfect. And so the stories have also been uploaded to the podcast as well. There's like 8 hours of stories as well, and then all the classes and stuff like that. So go to realestatefinancialplanner.com/podcast, and there's a ton of stuff up there where you guys can get access to all those as well. You can listen to it on iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, whatever, you know, whatever it is, MySpace, all those different technology things I don't know anything about. All right, here we go. Market stats. So this is the Northern Colorado Q3 2020 real estate market stats, and can everyone see that? Can everyone see the market stats page thing that I've got going on? Someone would let me know and I will go into full screen mode. Awesome, cool. So here it is, market stats. You guys can do screenshots if you want to, but I will publish this so you guys can just download the PDF. Might be a lot easier to read when you do the PDF and zoom in and stuff. So here's a whole bunch of data for the thing. I'm not going to go over this one in detail. You're welcome to go look at it, but it shows you the average price comparing different quarters to, you know, different quarters and what the change in, you know, the price for detached single family and attached single family, and it has little notes on there and how many were sold. I have charts for all this stuff. So if you want to look at the actual numbers and look at this data, you're welcome to. I'm pausing on it. So if you're watching the video, you have time to find the pause button and go and do it. But I will tell you, I'm not covering what's on the slide. Nor am I really going to go into detail on this one, but this one actually does show you a couple things I do want to point out. And that is, it shows you a whole bunch of cities in Northern Colorado, everything from Alt to Windsor alphabetically. And it shows you the, I'll just kind of give you an idea. This is all the cities on the left-hand side. It shows you the current number of active listings that are happening in the marketplace, the current number that are under contract, where someone is under contract to buy them, the percentage of the listings that are under contract, the number that have sold during this first time period, which is October 2018 through September 2019, and then the number sold during time period number two, which is October 2019 through September 2020. So they're kind of comparing two different year-long periods there, and it shows you how many there were, and then the net change of how many sales happened. So for example, in Fort Collins, it looks like we're up about 4% in the number of sold properties we had from last year to this year. So the number of sold properties has increased. And then it shows you the number of MOI, which is months of inventory. For those that don't know, let me go over what months of inventory is, because I believe it is probably one of the best and one of the most underutilized metrics in the real estate market for determining like what's going on in the marketplace. And the reason why I like it is it takes into account both the supply, the number of homes that we have for sale, and the demand, how many homes are selling in a marketplace, and gives it to you in one kind of like very convenient number. And so I'm going to explain to you how this works. So imagine for a minute, and I'm going to use really simple numbers. So imagine for a minute you were in a market where you had 10 properties currently for sale. And if you look back over the last 6 months of data or something like that, our average is we've been selling one house per month. So we've been selling one house per month, but we have 10 properties that are currently for sale. How many months would it take you, knowing that it takes one house per sale per month, that we're selling one house per month, how many months would it take you to get through all of our inventory where we have no properties left? And this is not a trick question. Guys can type it in. At least somebody's got to type it in. I'll wait. I'll take a drink. 10. Exactly. It wasn't like really hard math. It took you 10 months in order for you to get to the point where you went through all your inventory. So you could see that the months of inventory stats takes into account how many properties we have on the market and how quickly they're selling, such that it combines those numbers in a way where we can figure out how quickly are we going to run out of inventory if we didn't have any new properties coming in there. So really, if you think about that, it takes into account both supply and demand. So if we look at the months of inventory, for example, of Fort Collins, we only have 1 month selling at the current pace that we're selling to go through all of our inventory. So that's really low. And if you look at all the months of inventory kind of throughout all of Northern Colorado, our total for the entire area is 1.2 months of inventory. You'll see a chart here in a little bit, at least I think you will. You'll see a chart here in a little bit that shows you that the months of inventory historically over time, and you will find out that we're seeing pretty significant shortage of inventory and very high demand, a really strong sell-through ratio, such that the months of inventory look really, really low like right now for a lot of markets. And so that's one of the things we're seeing right now. So months of inventory gives you a really good idea of what's going on there. The other section right here is days on market. I also like that stat because it shows you how long it's taking properties to go under contract or to sell. So it shows you the previous time period and then the more recent time period and then what the change is. And I believe the negative numbers means that it's been faster, which means that the market is typically hotter. It's a more seller's market than a buyer's market. And so you can see all the ones that are negative here, that means that the market has gotten hotter. So Fort Collins, as an example, we're seeing about days on market. We see a change of 4. We're seeing about 64 days on market there to do that. And then like Loveland, where's Loveland? Loveland's kind of another big city. We're seeing about 65 days. So you can kind of get a feel for how many days on market. Find whatever city you're interested in. You can look at that. And then over here, it shows you the average asking price for properties that are listed and then what the average sold price for properties were last year, the average sold price for properties this year, and then the percentage change. Or this is one way to measure. It's not the way that I prefer to do it, but it is a way to measure what the appreciation rate is in the marketplace. Basically, you look at the average of all the sold properties last year, the average of all the sold properties this year, and you could see what the change in the average sold price was year over year, and it gives you a measure of appreciation. I don't like that one. For a lot of reasons, I don't know if I want to get into all the reasons, but there's different ways to calculate a change in price. And so the appreciation rate. So this one though gives you an idea of what the price change is. So for example, Fort Collins, we're seeing a average sale price change of up 7%. So we're seeing 7% more expensive property selling in Fort Collins. Longmont, let's see, Loveland right here. We're up 2% last year average to this year average. You're doing that. And Asa says, for days on market, is it time to sell or time to go under contract? My guess is sell. It's a super interesting question, Asa. And it's more complicated than you might imagine at first glance. So I believe in our local MLS, the days on market is actually calculated from the day that the property first gets listed for sale to the day it either goes pending, which is not the same as under contract, unfortunately, or active backup. It's the day that it goes pending or the day that it actually closes, whichever is earlier. And so in most cases, and this has to do with like how the status of a real estate agent changes the status of a property in our local MLS. So for most properties, a real estate agent will list the property as active, which means it's actively available for sale. People can go out and look at it and make an offer on it and everything else. Once the property typically goes under contract, where you have a buyer write a contract, the seller accepts that contract, and there's a active contract to buy and sell on the property, and then the buyer's doing all their due diligence, like their inspection and qualifying for their loan and ordering the appraisal and all that other stuff. And usually what happens is real estate agents will change the status from active to active backup. And active backup means that we are actively trying to market the property to look for a backup contract. So a secondary buyer to come in and write a contract on the property such that if the first contract falls through, then that buyer would automatically move to the first position and their contract will be in full force and effect. And I'm going to show you a chart here in a little bit that talks about what percentage of deals fall out of contract and why if you're a buyer in a really hot market, you may want to be in backup position, okay? So anyway, to get back to your question about the days on market thing, it is, they calculate it based on when it goes either pending, which I haven't even talked about yet, or it goes and sells. And so some agents, not most, will actually convert a property to pending once they get past all of the deadlines where a buyer can cancel. So they've gotten through inspection, they've gotten through their title work, they've gotten through the appraisal, they've gotten through their last financing contingency, and they're waiting those last couple days for the property to actually go and close, where the buyer closes, goes to the title company, brings the money, closes on the property, and the seller no longer owns it. And so some agents, very few, will actually change their property from active backup to pending at that period of time, where it's just pending closing and they're no longer looking for a backup offer on it. And how it really works for most of the time is the agent just leaves it active backup until it actually closes. And so this tends to be, this is a really long-winded way around telling you that in most cases, it means that it is from time that it goes under contract till when it closes. So yes, that is the long answer to that question. And because I have fewer slides, I can take time and answer those questions like that. So let me know if anyone has any questions there. Okay, cool. So we talked about, you're very welcome. So average sold price, you can kind of look at those wherever you want to do there. And then this last column is the average discount. And if you remember from when I've taught my crazy market stats class and I just go to Freaky Town, I used to have these like insane charts where I could show you like the discount from list price, and I'd show you like the range of discount, you know, like the 80% of the time it's below this, and 20% of the time it's below this. And, you know, I could show you seasonality and I could show you all sorts of crazy stuff. This is the like really cheesy version of that, where they just say across all the properties, the average discount that we're seeing on properties that you're buying is whatever this number here is. So like for Four Collins, as an example, if I line this up correctly, looks like it's 0.7% discount. So on a $400,000 property, it's less than $4,000 as a discount. And by the way, that discount does include any negotiations that happen from inspection stuff and appraisal stuff. So realize it is not like getting your offer accepted discount. It is the discount from when it was listed to when it closes. So kind of a little nuanced point there, but that can make a big thing. If you're thinking to yourself, well, first of all, 0.7 is not that much to begin with. If you're trying to, you know, make an offer and get it accepted, kind of like lowball kind of thinking there. But, you know, 0.7 is not that much to begin with. Realize you may have had to make a full price offer in order to be under contract. And then when you negotiate all your stuff on your inspection and maybe the appraisal doesn't come in because maybe it was priced a little bit high to begin with or whatever it was, then you actually were able to negotiate a slight discount on it. So realize that number is a little bit deceptive. Man, I'm all over the place tonight, which I think is good. Okay, so house market summary thing. And then down here, it breaks it out. Instead of doing by city, they broke it out by square footage amount. So you could see, hey, look, the smallest 10% of the square footage properties, here's how many there were of those, the price, the discount, all that other stuff. Here's the biggest properties, the biggest 10%. And then they break it down into a whole bunch of other ranges of square footage. And I think this is independent of city. It just shows you approximate sizes of properties and then what the number of active under contract, percentage that are under contract, the sold price, change in sold price, days on market, average sold, months of inventory, all that stuff for properties based on their square footage. So if you want to go look at that, you can. Cody has a question here. Does the negative mean it is closing for 0.7% over or under additional original asking price? Cody, in this case, I think it is actually a discount. So it is less than the price that I originally went under contract for. That's what my understanding of these stats. I didn't actually do the calculations for this, but that's how I would understand it. And that's what I would expect to see on this particular thing. Okay, that's what I got to say about that. Hold the home price markets detached single family. Okay, so these are detached single family homes. So not condos, not townhomes. And it shows you a bunch of different cities. Here are some more like, I don't know, I'd almost consider these Denver-like cities, maybe because I consider anything, you know, south of Harmony and Fort Collins to be basically Mexico. So these are all like Denver-ish cities here. And then up here is like more of the Northern Colorado type stuff. This shows you the trailing 12 months TTM, that's what that stands for, average price. So basically Fort Collins, the trailing 12 months average price was 503. The average price in Loveland was 435,000. Greeley was 340,000. All of Northern Colorado combined, including Boulder, which Boulder's kind of an anomaly in some ways, is 506. And then the price change for that 12 months trailing from the beginning to the end of it. It shows you kind of like how much the property values have gone up. And then here's that months of inventory, the moi thing again. And this is super interesting because you could see it's ridiculously low. I mean, Boulder's got 2.2 months of inventory, which is pretty low by itself. And then everything else is sub two. So it shows you that we have really low inventory available, not a lot of properties available for sale based on the pace at which we're selling things. And then this shows you how many homes were sold, broken out by city, to kind of give you an idea. Any questions on that? Going once, going twice. Already done. Okay. Oh, this is actually a super interesting chart. So this shows you going all the way back to 2010, going through to October 2020, it shows you the number of homes we've had actively for sale. And I believe this has got to be all of Northern Colorado. Let's see. We had 13,000 sold. Yes, this is probably all of Northern Colorado. So this shows you like how many homes were actively for sale. You could see the peaks and valleys as we do that. That's usually seasonality. So we tend to have more homes available for sale over it's kind of like summer months. The 6 months over the summer is kind of like that peak area. And then the 6 months over the winter period of time is sort of the lower time when you have stuff like that. But you could see that even though you've got peaks and valleys, the trend overall is down. So since 2010, when we had all of our homes going for short sales and a lot of foreclosure stuff and people trying to sell their real estate and stuff like that, we had a ton of inventory on the market and a relative small number of properties that we're selling. That's the red lines down here. This is a number of sold properties. So we had a ton of choice, a lot of properties that you could go see, a lot of properties that were available. You had a huge selection of stuff. And that over the last decade or so, especially the last 6 years, we saw the number of properties that were available for sale declining. And if you've been thinking about, since 2016 or so, man, there's really not a lot of properties that come on the market and they're moving pretty quickly when we do see them. Yeah, that's what this chart is showing you, is that we have really, really low inventory compared to what we used to see a decade ago. And so we had this huge decline in the number of properties that were sale. But look at this. The number that have been selling, they've been slowly on the rise, but not significantly. All this stuff is seasonality, the like little bumps, each one. But what's super interesting about right now is the amount of properties that are actively for sale are getting very close to the point where that's the number that are selling. This is like, it's not been this close in a decade. So we have really crazy inventory stuff going on right now where we don't have a lot of properties that are for sale and we're selling through those and we're selling about what we're listing. Pretty nutso. Hunter says, do you typically see houses sell for higher rates in the summer months because of more competition? Is it significant? So Hunter, it's a very deceptive question. And I'd have to dig in more to give you a real answer. But the challenge is this. Let's say the people that are selling the $3 million houses in our marketplace all decide to list in the summer. What that does is it skews the price that people are paying on average way higher in the summer months than it does in the winter months. So when you take into account like the mix of properties that are being sold, it may even look like the summer months are higher than the ones in the winter. What you'd want to do, in my opinion, is probably look at if you could, some type of like same house price ratio, like does the same type of house sell more in the summer than it does in the winter, which I do think that is slightly true. Because I think that you have more people looking and you have better inventory out there. And then also, you may also want to look at the price per square foot too, to kind of eliminate that as an issue. So it's more complicated than I think you'd like it to be. You'd like me to basically say, yeah, I mean, they sell for higher rates in the summer months because of that. And I think that is probably slightly true, but I've not pulled out the data. I've not kind of teased out the data to take out of account, like, are we eliminating the higher priced properties in the summer or, ones that are bigger square footage or things like that. So I haven't removed that data. My guess is that maybe a little bit. And it just makes sense, right? I mean, if you are selling a property between Thanksgiving and Christmas, there's probably a reason why you're doing that, because that's not the best time for you to be having your family be disrupted to do showings around Thanksgiving and Christmas time. So you're usually slightly motivated to do that, which means that you're probably having a slight discount on price for some of those reasons. So yeah, I would think it is a little bit. Yep. All right, cool. I think I finished this chart. It's kind of an interesting thing though, where we're seeing inventory go and that our demand is so really, really high for that. Okay. So, oh, here you go. Here's a whole chart on months of inventory. So this kind of explains what months of inventory is and how it works. It was high in the mid to late 80s, reflecting our slow Denver market at the time. This is partly Denver, partly Fort Collins, partly Northern Colorado. And so it shows you a whole bunch of stuff around that. It says during the 90s, months of inventory was under 4. Strong seller's market. It began increasing and leveled off around 2004 at the 6 to 7 range, which is slightly buyer's market. And then it began to kind of like change and stuff like that. So what does it mean for you as a client? It says it is critical for your clients to understand the market in order to make correct decisions. The low months of inventory means a strong seller's market. Sellers are in control when there's not a lot of properties to pick from and the demand from buyers is really strong. Okay, think about that. So multiple offers, super picky sellers, meaning that they're being a little bit more picky about which offers they accept and they're negotiating some of the finer points in the offer before they accept it. And then buyers need to have their act together with strong contracts, pre-qual letters, et cetera. All that, we did an entire class of making strong offers that get accepted. When we have really low months of inventory, all those things apply, okay? And then sellers, use this to help show your sellers how strong the market is to list, educate them on the difference, and then buyers, educate serious buyers on how to be a strong buyer, which we've talked about in classes before. So here's that historical context going all the way back to 2010, all the way through to 2020. And it shows you the number of months of inventory. And this blue line is Northern Colorado. So back in 2010, we had about almost 10 months of inventory. So it would have taken us 10 months to sell through the number of properties that we had listed for sale based on the amount that people were buying. That's a really strong buyer's market. This whole area above this dotted line is considered a buyer's market. This kind of like mid blue area is considered a balanced market where the buyers and sellers are sort of like equally footed for negotiating against each other. Okay. So we typically have that. And so back in 2012 is when we saw sort of a balanced market in Northern Colorado, and 2013 remained in there. After 2013, we sort of transitioned into more of a seller's market. In 2014, that was less than 4 months of inventory. And then it has slowly declined. Maybe this is up a tiny bit, but it's basically declined ever since, such that in 2019, we were less than 2 for all of the Northern Colorado market. And then this black line shows you just the third quarters for 2016, 2017, 2018, 2019. And then I'm showing you what 2020 is with this really low section here, showing you that we are at what I would consider to be extreme low months of inventory. Extreme low months of inventory. Craziness. And this red line gives you an idea of Denver. Denver has a little bit lower months of inventory than even we're seeing in Northern Colorado. So all the people from Denver look like, oh, I can't find deals in Denver. Guess where? I'm going to go to Northern Colorado because they got plenty of deals and their deals are better anyway. And so they're coming up here trying to steal all your deals, doing that. Maybe not so much, but that's what they're trying to do. They think, oh, they got plenty more inventory than we do. It's a lot better inventory searching than we got down here. All right. Any questions on that before I continue on? Let me take a drink. All right, then. All right, here's some condo stuff. Very similar to what we talked about before. Again, I'm not going to go over this, but it does show you the number of active under contract, the percentage that are under contract. It shows you that time period 1 of how many sold, time period 2, how many sold, the net change from the first time period to the second time period, number of months of inventory, which I'll just point out, the attached properties, condos, even very, very low months of inventory. The average for the entire Northern Colorado market is 2.0 months of inventory, but that's just ridiculously low. Days on market shows you all those. The average sold price kind of gives you some idea between those two time periods. And then the discount we're seeing on those condos. Okay. And then it also breaks them down by square footage. So I will pause ever so gently for the briefest amount of time in case somebody wants to find the pause button while they're watching the video, and you guys can drill into this or just go download it from that realestatefinancialplanner.com/market-stats if you want to go dig into any individual city. I will tell you, grand total wise, we got 2 months of inventory for the entire condo market up there. We had an increase to 6.9 days on market, which honestly isn't significant. It's a week. I wouldn't consider that a pretty significant change. And then we're seeing, on average, across all of the different cities, a 0.8% discount from list price by the time you close on the property. Okay. That's all I got about that. How the markets compare. Now, these are the attached, like condos and townhomes, single family homes. And again, this is the trailing 12 months, shows you the average price. So in four columns, the average price of a condo or townhome that sold in the last 12 months, 325, Loveland 323, Greeley 254, all of Northern Colorado, including Boulder, which Boulder, in my opinion, is a sort of an outlier, is 376, just because it's its own world. You know, Boulder's kind of a world unto itself in some ways, kind of just price and stuff like that. So Northern Colorado, all $376,000, shows you the change in price over that time period, the number of months of inventory over that time period, broken out by city, and then the number of homes sold over that time period. And then it's got a whole bunch of other stuff. And then again, this is the attached homes, the condos and townhomes, if you want to dig into this a little bit more. Okay. This shows you the historical price change, the average home price change, comparing Northern Colorado to Denver. So it shows you Northern Colorado is this dark blue line. And all the way going back to 2010, the average home price in 2010, I hate to upset you guys, but if you were buying back in, it's like amazing here. But the average home price for this here was 275-ish. And we go all the way up here. And right now, the average home price, 2019 looked like, whatever that is, just under 500K. The quarter three number that we just finished here is just over 500 that we've seen here. Denver appreciated slightly faster, appreciated because this is the average of all the homes sold. And I hate to use this, I hate to use this number as a real appreciation rate. Although some people do. Some people use the change in price of the average sales price year over year as their appreciation rate. I don't think it's fair. I mean, you could be selling larger properties in your marketplace, and all of a sudden you think property values really went up, when in fact you just ended up having a larger number of properties, properties that are larger square footage wise just sell more frequently in your marketplace. Or maybe you sold more luxury properties in your marketplace, and so that really raised the price up, whereas all the property values could have remained the same. So I think this is it's one of my least favorite ways of calculating appreciation. I think at a minimum, you'd want to do a price per square foot delta, change in price per square foot over time, do that. And I think that the best way to do it is actually same house change when you have one house that sold 1 year, and then you kind of track that same house 4 or 5 years later and you see what it sold for then, and you do the calculation based on that. And that's what the Office of Housing and Economic something or other, the OHEO or whatever the government organization is that does same house over house sales for calculating the appreciation rate. That's my favorite way of doing appreciation, because it actually does the same house sold two times where you take the change of price over there. I think that's the fairest way to do an appreciation rate. Wow, I'm going like way off on tangents. Okay, so here's kind of the price. It shows you that Denver has appreciated a little bit faster. It says condos are nearly the same price. This must be... Yeah, this is not just condos. Oh, the condos right here. So condos are really, this is what they're saying here. So for the Northern Colorado stuff, the price for condos back in 2010 was about 200 that was Northern Colorado. In Denver, they were probably like 160. And then they actually caught up to be what the prices for Northern Colorado around 2015 or so. A little bit of a differentiation here between the prices. But eventually, right now in 2019 or so, the prices for condos in Northern Colorado are very similar to what the prices for Denver are for average sale price of condos. So I don't know, that's pretty interesting to me that we're seeing the same price for Northern Colorado as Denver for this price there. This shows you Greeley, Greeley's price over time. It shows you back in 1984, the average price, went back. The average price of all transactions, homes and condos in Greeley back in 1984 was 60 something thousand, maybe $70,000, whatever it is here. And that kind of did narrow sideways channel for a while till like 1992. And then we saw some pretty significant appreciation all the way through to about 2005. In 2005, we saw the start of a decline in Greeley. It kind of bottomed out in, I don't know, whatever this is, 2010, 2011, maybe even into 2012. Then we started seeing a recovery, kind of broke out of the narrow sideways channel right around 2014 and increased. Now prices in Greeley are over 300. The overall average annual appreciation rate using this average sale price for the year kind of change has been 5.7%. For that entire period of time. So what is that? 84 to 2016 years, 16 plus 20, 36 years. So about 36 years worth of data shows that if you were going to use an appreciation rate, which I don't like using this one, but an appreciation rate in Greeley, it's been 5.7%. So if you're kind of getting a feel for what that is in Greeley, that's what you may want to use. Okay. Here's the Fort Collins similar kind of chart. It goes all the way back to 1978 in this case. Really saw some pretty significant appreciation starting like 1990 all the way through to 2005. 2005, we saw a narrow sideways channel till about 2014. And then 2014 really saw prices in Fort Collins pick up more significant than I think we've ever seen historically going back to 1978 at least. And so you can see all those numbers. The average annual appreciation rate going all the way back to 1978 using this method of the average sales price year over year change has been 5.1% per year. Now, as a side note, for those of you that have come on and heard me talk about deal analysis and all sorts of other stuff, and you hear like 5.1% for appreciation rate, and you know, I'm telling you to put in 3% for your appreciation rate when you do deal analysis, why am I doing that? Am I trying to like torpedo and kill all your deals? No, I'm trying to make it more conservative for you, because the more conservative number of this is the Case-Shiller number, which has 100 years of data, not just this 1978 to 2020. Now, it's not specific to Northern Colorado. It's a nationwide number, but it basically shows that over 100 years of data, the appreciation rate of all real estate in the United States has basically kept pace with inflation. The inflation rate was, I think, 3.1, and the home prices were like a 3%, or actually it's the other way around. I think like inflation was just over 3, and then the home price appreciation was 3.1. And so historically, over a very long period of time, home prices have mimicked what the inflation rate is on a nationwide level. Of course, you can have property values go up in any specific, you know, subdivision faster than stuff. I mean, think about Old Town Fort Collins as an example, or probably Old Town Boulder, if I had to guess. You know, look, those areas probably appreciate faster than, you know, just the state as a general, or a specific city in general. So you can kind of like realize that you're going to have subspecialties with this. But I think using 3% is conservative. If you do better, amazing, right? Bonus for you. If you do worse, I mean, realize that sometimes properties don't perform to what they've done historically. And that's, you know, over a long period of time, I would still think it'd be close to that 3%. But in any given year, we can see negative numbers, right? I mean, we definitely saw price declines here, even in Fort Collins. Okay. Oh, I was going to take a drink. That's why I took off the thing. If you guys got questions, let me know. I feel like I'm just going on a rant. All right, so here's Boulder. I'm going to skip it. If you are from Boulder, pause the screen. You got to be really fast. If you're from Boulder, you need to be able to pause the video fast and be able to look at this, but I'm not going to cover it. I will tell you their annual appreciation rate has been 5.5%. Okay, housing crisis. This is a super interesting chart. So if you've been sleeping up to this point, you should wake up, because this is really cool. So what this shows is the 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, the last six recessions we've had. And it shows you how the housing market has performed during these recessions. And I can show you the national numbers, what we basically did nationally. I can show you Denver, Colorado Springs, and Fort Collins. Okay, so pay attention here. This is really interesting. And this is a metro statistical areas is how they did these calculations. So, and the like the subheading of this slide, according to the notes, is a recession does not equate to a housing crisis. And we're about to show you that. So back in 1980, we were in a recession, and the national housing appreciation rate was 6.1% during the recession. Okay. Fort Collins did 8.6% appreciation during the recession. Colorado Springs, 9.9%, and Denver did 13.6%. Denver just crushed it, okay? 1981, the nation did 3.5%. Fort Collins did negative 1.6%, so not a pretty significant decline. And then Colorado Springs did something ridiculous, 21.6%. And then Denver did only 4.8% positive. Okay. So Fort Collins was a little bit negative in 1981. 1990, the nation did negative 1.9%. So the nation was down a little bit, but Fort Collins was actually up 3.3%. And Colorado Springs was up 0.4%. And Denver was up 5.8% during the 1990 recession. And then apparently 2001 was another recession. The nation was up 6.6%. Fort Collins was up 5.7%. Colorado Springs, 5.1%. And Denver, 4.7%. 2007, that was the ugly one, right? That was like the real estate crash, the biggest real estate crash we've seen in our lifetime. And so the national number was negative 19.7 for that. Fort Collins did remarkably well, negative 1.4 comparatively. And then Colorado Springs did negative 3.8. And Denver did negative 16%. So Fort Collins did remarkably well during this last biggest, real estate recession crisis thing going on here. And then I'll do 2020 and then I'll get to the questions. I see there's some here. So 2020, we're basically in a recession now. The nation has been up 4% for house prices. Fort Collins is up 0.9% according to this. Colorado Springs up 1.5%, and then Denver is up 1.5%. So let's take a look at some of these questions here. Okay. Vojta, I think that's how you say your name. Do you know why did the Springs do so well in 1981? I don't know. Yeah, I really don't know Colorado Springs' history there, so I can't really tell you. If anyone else happens to know, please make sure you're on all panelists and attendees and let us all know. And then CeCe says, out of curiosity, why did Colorado Springs spike with others in 1981? Same question. I don't know. So if anyone happens to know that, please let us know. Steve says, back to the sales price change over time, do they look at correlation between sales prices and rental rates? I don't think they do in this presentation. I'll tell you that. They may have, if you go to the realestatefinancialplanner.com/market-stats/, that page has stuff about income properties on there. And if I'm not mistaken, Steve, they do have a section in there about the rate of change of rental property prices. I'm not sure if they're plotting it versus home price appreciation though. I think they're plotting it versus vacancy. But if you want to go there and look at it, maybe after the recording or something like that. But if you happen to do it like multitask and download it while you're on the call here and you want to share with everybody else, you can totally do that. But I don't think they're doing the home price appreciation. I have seen a home price and rent appreciation chart before on a national level, and which I've included in other presentations, but I don't have it from your castle stuff. And there was a strong correlation between home prices and rents increasing at about the same rate. Sometimes you'll see prices go up a little bit and rents not, and then sometimes you'll see rents go up and prices not. But like the overall trend is for them to go up together, but it's not like lockstep where every time home prices go up, rents go up. We've definitely seen home prices go up for a few years and then rents trail behind. And then we've seen it go the other way too. So it is not a like every single year, they're always lockstep going up the exact same amount and stuff like that. So yeah. Yep. I do have some charts coming at the end too. And maybe if you want to superimpose them or something like that, we can kind of like merge the data. But I do have some other stuff like part of my, the stuff after this presentation. Okay. Current market. This is just a breakdown of the Northern Colorado homes based on the above grade square footage numbers. So you can see like the smallest 10% of properties that are for sale, the largest 10% of properties for sale, and then a breakdown of some different like just make sense sort of like areas of size. And it shows you like how many properties there are. So there's not a lot of these really small ones. There's a few more of these really large ones, but the bulk of the market sort of in this middle thing shows you the number of sold listings. This is active listings, by the way. This shows you the number of sold listings, the number of months of inventory. So like the ones that have that are like the biggest and the most expensive, those are the ones that we have the most inventory of. The ones that we have the least inventory of are the low end. And then here's the price change of those over, I think this is over a year, my guess. Oh, it shows right here, the time frame, October 18 through September 19, then October 2019 through September 2020. And then the months of inventory this time last year. So it shows you like how the months of inventory compared, and we're all way lower in number of months of inventory than we were this time. So this is last year around this time. This is this year. And you can see we have a shortage of inventory. That's like the like theme of this particular slide deck is inventory is really, really low. Demand for properties is really high. Market's hot. Interest rates are low. I could have saved you all the time, guys. I could have just given you that at the very beginning. You would have been done. Okay. I might need more beverage. Okay, here we go. And this compares similar things to the Denver market as well. And it shows you like the months of inventory. I'm not going to cover this slide. If you really want to dig in and compare how Northern Colorado is compared to Denver in terms of months of inventory based on single family homes on above grade square footage, this is the slide for you. I'm not going to cover it. All right, and then here's condos. So same type of idea, broken out by square footage for all the condo things. It's just what we just talked about. And you can see the inventory levels are really low. That's really what I'm going to pull out from here. But if you want to go look at condos, you can do that. And then here's the condo comparison from Northern Colorado comparing to Denver. So if you want to compare how Denver is doing, there's a lot more for sale, I'll tell you that for sure, in Denver than there are here in Northern Colorado. But if you want to compare this, this is the point in the presentation where you want to pause it and look at that slide. Okay, so this is an interesting one. And I'm going to go through this relatively fast because I've got a better slide for this than I think I have after this presentation. But this shows you some historical perspective on interest rates. So all the way back in the 1970s, interest rates were 7 to 9%. It says the average for the decade of the 70s was 9%, according to the bottom of this. Then we had the 80s, where we saw interest rates peak at almost 17%. This is mortgage interest rates. And that the average for the 80s was 13%. That was the average mortgage interest rate. And then we went into the 90s, the interest rates kind of declined through here. In the 90s, the average interest rate was 8%. And then in the aughts, the 2000 to 2010, we had an average interest rate about 6.5. And then in the 2010s through kind of like, I think this goes through 2016, the average interest rate has been 4.1. And the historical argument that a lot of people have made is they tend to cut off this chart like right around here. And they basically say, look, we're at all-time low interest rates and you should really be buying properties now. The average has been 8% or whatever it's been over this last whole period of time. And now we're at like 4% or 3.5% or whatever it is. You should be buying property because interest rates are amazing, amazing, amazing. And this is not normal. They're abnormally low and stuff like that. And there is a little bit of truth to that. But if you guys have seen any of the classes I've done where I really dive deep into interest rates, historical mortgage interest rates and long-term debt type interest rates, you can see I look back way further than 1970 and I show you that it's not unusual to have these long-term interest rates be in that 4% range. It's not unusual at all. And in fact, this is the anomaly, the 17% that we saw sort of in the 1970s and 80s. That's sort of the exception to the rule. It's not that we typically see 8% and that we're exceptionally low now. It's like, 4% seems pretty reasonable. 4 to 5, I think if I remember those charts correctly, I think that seems like a reasonable interest rate. Go watch those previous classes where I show those charts and show you a lot more detail. That's not the one I'm going to show you here in a bit. But you can see they really are at all-time lows. I just had a client who's on this call right now. I think they told me they were quoted 2.625 for 5% down owner-occupant interest rate and 3% for a 25% down non-owner occupants, investor type loan with a little bit of costs in order to lock in that rate. 30-year fixed rate financing. That's like blow your mind low, like crazy, 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 crazy low right now. Okay. So like, where are we in this? We're like at all-time lows, just ridiculous. CC says, do you know what caused the unusual 17%? I don't want to misspeak, but my understanding is that part of it was political, economic movement type stuff is my remembrance of some of this stuff. I think part of it was going off gold standard. I think, and by the way, I don't think I was even alive during that point. I guess I was barely alive. So I think it's some of that. I have not studied that time, that period of history, and don't really know, but I think that's sort of what happened there. But someone can go and do that thing. Maybe someone older than me that remembers it can tell us. Okay, so here's the question that apparently people have been asking and these guys get is, when will all the foreclosures start? You know, we're in this recession. The real estate market's going crazy. What are we seeing here? Like, what is what? Like, when are we going to see all these foreclosures and short sales like we did in 2010? I'm ready. I got money. I'm like ready to go. Interest rates are all times low. Let's go. Let's go. Let's go. Let's go. Where are the foreclosures? I want to buy them all. Well, not so fast. Okay. Only 3% of U.S. homes are currently underwater, where the home value is less than the mortgage balance, where they owe more than the property is worth, while 97% have equity. Therefore, we won't see any material increase in foreclosure activity from the COVID crisis. Everyone who loses a job or has economic trouble will just list the normal way, sell, and harvest their equity. Of all the active forbearances which are past due on their mortgage payment, 77% have at least 20% of equity in their home. Okay. So this is a chart showing some of that data. So this shows you the percentage of homes underwater. This goes all the way back to 2010, back when 25% of the homes out there, 25% of all properties, this must be 25% of, I don't know if that's true. At 25% of properties are underwater, where they owe more than the property is worth. That was back in 2010. And it has been on a pretty steady decline since then, such that in the fourth quarter of 2019, maybe even a little bit later than that, I can't tell where this actually line is at, less than 5%. It says 3% are underwater. So when you have property values that have been going up very rapidly for the last decade, people have a ton of equity in their property. And so we're not likely to see a lot of foreclosures like that. And then here is the percentage of equity in active forbearance currently past due. So these are people that they asked for a forbearance where they didn't have to make their mortgage payment. They went to their lender and they said, I can't make the payment. I got job loss or I've got some type of financial distress. I'm unable to make it. Can you please like give me a payment reprieve and add the payment to the back or do a forgiveness or whatever they ended up doing. Most of them had it get added in some way. But here it shows you what percentage of equity they have of the people that are currently past due. 59% of people have more than 30% of equity. So a ton of them have a ton of equity. And then 18% have between 20 and 30% equity in their property. 13% have between 10 and 20%. 9% have between 0 and 10%, and only 1% of the people that are in active forbearance that are currently past due have negative equity, that they're underwater. This is national. So Steve, it's that chart, national, local. This is national, okay? So I don't think we're going to see a lot of foreclosures. That's my guess. Will we see foreclosures? Sure. We see foreclosures even in the best of markets because people have life situations come up and things happen to them. But are we going to see this like onslaught like we saw in 2010? I don't think so. At least that's not what the data is showing right now. Things could change, but I'm not seeing that right now at all. Okay. Now, remember before I talked to you about like you may want to consider being in backup position? This is the chart that talks about will my deal close? And they show the percentage of the deals that fall out of contract is declining slightly. So it shows you what percentage of deals fell out of contract. So back in 2014, about 21% or 1 out of 5 deals approximately would actually not make it to the closing line. So they go under contract, everyone's in love, they love the property, everything's going great, but then 1 out of 5 don't make it to closing. Either they fall out for inspection, they can't get the loan, it doesn't appraise, they can't come to terms on something. And so about 1 out of 5 back in 2014, it dipped down to 20%, which is basically 1 out of 5, went up to 22%, down to 21% in 2018, went up to 23% in 2019, 25% in Q1 of 2020, about 25% in Q2. And it's been steady, about 18 to 25%. So this is not a significant risk. However, if you're in a really hot market and it's hard for you to find a deal and you are actively making offers on properties, If you don't get your offer accepted, especially if you're a client of ours, we're going to have this conversation where we talk about, would you like to try to go to them and say, can we be in backup position in case the first offer falls through? Because about 1 out of 5 to as much as 1 out of 4 of those properties will fall out of contract, and you will be able to be in the first position if the first contract falls through, if you're in backup. Okay. And so there's a whole bunch of strategy about that as to what will happen there. And again, the loan to value doesn't impact the deal failure rate. So if you think to yourself, well, am I more likely to get it if someone's doing an FHA loan, or am I more likely to have a deal fall apart if I accept a 5% down conventional loan, or is it more likely to close if someone's putting 25% down? It turns out if they're under 50% loan to value, 22% of them fall through. If they're 51 to 74%, 18% fall through. If it's 75 to 80% loan to value, 22% fall through. And then if it's 81% to 95%, 21% of them fall through. So there's no strong correlation between how much you put down and whether or not the deal goes through. Remember that when you're on the selling side as to which offer to accept. And there's other reasons to kind of like be critical about different loan types coming in when you're accepting offers as a seller, but it's not whether or not they'll complete the transaction. This data shows that that's really not a trend. That's not a factor, a correlated factor, okay? Any questions on that? Because I have another slide related to things. Steve says, is that speculations or another factor? I don't know what you're asking, Steve, if you want to kind of clarify. Voita, I think if you sign up for a backup offer, you might increase a chance for that original offer to go through. I do think that that is a potential thing, is that that could help motivate the first offer to be reasonable with their negotiations and to come to terms. But it doesn't really matter that much. I still think you're better off being in the backup position than not being in the backup position, because imagine for a minute that you had 10 offers on the property. One person got accepted, 9 did not. I would much rather be the one that goes in backup position there than to have to do, it goes back on the market and now you've got 9 other people bidding on it again, and they lost out last time and they really like that property and now they're going to bid it up. I'd rather you go in there and be in backup position there. Steve says, why they fall out? Could be any reason, like inspection, title work, the appraisal, they can't get their loan. Something came up where they're fired from their job. I mean, all those things like that. Luke says, can you put offers on multiple properties at one time? Yes, but it's complicated and you want to make sure you have the proper paperwork in place and you want to have someone talk to you about the risks of doing that. So definitely talk to your real estate agent to do it right. If you do it wrong, it's really ugly. If you do it right, it's fine. So yes, you can though. CC says, how does one offer in backup position add a clause? Yeah, it's again, you need to have the right paperwork in place, but you can make your offer a backup offer, and it requires some special paperwork to do it. C says, okay, thanks. Mary says, so if there were 10 offers, the backup offer takes precedence over the others. Yeah, so Mary, basically it works like this. There were 10 offers on the property. There are 10 offers put out in front of the table virtually, in front of the seller. The seller says, okay, I don't like these 4. You know, they're just not good terms. I'm narrowing it down to these 6. I'm going to eliminate that one. I'm going to eliminate this one. Okay, these 3 all look really, really close. I'm going to pick this one. This one looks like the best offer for me. I'm going to accept that offer. The other 9 get rejected. Okay, so now the seller is under contract with one offer for that one buyer. So the seller and buyer are under contract. Now, if one of the other 9 that got rejected is smart, they're going to go back to the agent that represents the seller and say, hey, I realize you accepted this offer. Would you consider accepting our offer as a backup? And in some cases, once they get the first one in place and they're working on the negotiations for inspection, all that other stuff, in some cases, the seller's agent will say, yeah, I think that'll help us. And to Voitch's point, like before, this may actually encourage the first one to close, but you also want to be there in case they get unreasonable or they fall out for financing or whatever it is the reason that they can't do it. And so you put in a totally separate contract with the second buyer that says, I am in backup position, and this only goes into effect if the first contract is terminated. And so you have all that in place so that once the first contract decides not to move forward, they use one of their outs of the contract and they terminate, then immediately the second contract becomes the first contract in position, and it becomes the active, fully executed contract. The other eight don't even get notified because they already have a contract in place. Got it? Yep, that's how it works. All right. You guys like this sort of class? Is this helpful for you guys? Okay, good. At least two of you like it. All right, so here's more on will my deal close. Will a cash deal close more frequently than a finance deal? Turns out, nope, not really. Cash deals fall out 25% of the time. Loans fall out 23% of the time. Luxury deals are slightly more likely to fall out of contract than non-luxury price deals. So the cheapest 10%, there's a 22% fallout. The middle 80% have a 21% fallout rate. The luxury top 10% have 24% fallout rate, not significant in my opinion. And overall, it's 22% of the properties that fall out of contract. Okay. In case this lesson wasn't driven home enough in all of the classes about Nomad and stuff like that, here's a very slightly different way of them presenting it. The net worth of homeowners is so significantly higher than the net worth of renters that they're claiming homeowners really are the, quote, one percenters, right? They're the ones that have all the money because they have all this equity in their property. And they're kind of like doing this little tongue in cheek, like this kind of, you know, sort of saying this. The average net worth of a U.S. homeowner in 2012, which I think was the last time this study was done, they have updated numbers on the next slide, was $174,000. $174,500. That was the average net worth of a U.S. homeowner, compared to $5,100 of the average renter. I'm going to pause for dramatic effect. $175,000 to $5,000. That's a pretty drastic difference in net worth. And that's the difference here is homeowner versus renter. Okay. The numbers are shocking, and renters definitely aren't aware of this situation. So educate them, let them know if they want to build wealth over time. Owning a home is the tried and true formula for doing that. Investors, landlords with a few rental properties, that's all you guys, you do even better because you have more properties. The more the world changes, the more it stays the same. Buying a home is the right thing to do to house one's family and build long-term wealth, or they could just make their landlord happy, all you guys, and wealthy forever, whichever they choose. So what does this mean? This is the updated numbers, apparently, and I don't know what this is Federal Reserve, must be third quarter 2020. So the homeowner net worth now is $231,400 compared to $5,200 for the renter net worth difference. It's crazy, crazy good. 45 times, apparently, more net worth for the homeowner than the renter over their lifetime. That's just ridiculous numbers. And Mary says, isn't some of that homeowner net worth also debt? Nope, it's not. So the definition of net worth is the value of the property minus any debts you have. So it's the difference between the value of the property minus debt. And so, no, it doesn't actually, it's not like you take that number and then you subtract the debt. It already includes the debt being subtracted. Yep, good question though. Okay, should I buy now? So this is an interesting way that they show whether or not you should buy a property now versus waiting a year. And they kind of talk about some of their assumptions and stuff like that. I'm not sure I'm going to go into the crazy assumptions they do on this page. If you want to read through it, you totally can. I'm just going to give you the abridged version of this and show you. They're assuming you buy a $250,000 property if you can find one in Northern Colorado. So you buy a $250,000 property, you put 5% down. That's $12,500 in down payment. They're assuming you're getting a 4% interest rate. Interest rates right now for 5% down, owner-occupant are like 2.625 as of this week. So they're a little bit high, conservative in that. A 30-year amortization, this is what your payment would be, $1,134. And they're saying property values are going up 5% a year. I think that's a little optimistic. It's what we've seen recently, especially, but I think it's a little optimistic. But let's just say it is 5%. And the appreciation dollar basically went up this amount over 10 years. I think this is a 10-year period that they're doing. So $157,000 is what the appreciation benefit was over a 10-year period on a $250,000 property. And the simple ROI, it's ridiculous. It's like 1,200%. But if you wait 12 months, we assume the mortgage interest rates are going up. Maybe they're 0.5% higher. The home price appreciation has happened 0.5, I'm sorry, plus 5%. So it's a little bit more expensive. So your payments, if you wait a year, interest rates go up and the property value increases by 5%, is going to be $1,263. It changes by about 11%. So it's 11% more expensive as terms of monthly payments if you wait a year in order to get involved in buying a property, even to live in, just kind of like owner-occupant. And this shows you the chart. This shows you the home value over time. This shows you your mortgage balance over time is going down. And this shows you your equity. You had that 5% equity to start with, and it's increasing as the property value goes up and as your debt gets paid down. So that after a 10-year period or so, looks like you got about $225,000 in equity between the property value going up and the debt being paid off. Okay. So it kind of gives you an idea about that. So the lesson here is, you guys are all fine. You're all investors coming on these calls and stuff like that. But for those of you that don't own a home yet, or that have friends and family that don't, this is the slide to show them as to why they should buy a house, even if it's just like a house to live in, not even for investment. Okay. I'm going to skip Boulder just because, I don't know, Boulder's Boulder. But here's Fort Collins home prices. This shows you a full year average sold price. So going all the way back to 2010, 271. I'm sure that's, it's got to be thousands, $271,000, all the way up here to like 475 in 2019. And for quarter three, it's like, you know, over five or something like that. And so you can see the linear, like, curve, fitting the curve for the price. The average growth per year is 7%. For the average Fort Collins home price. And then here's the number of homes that were sold. We peaked out in 2013, and then we've been on the decline as the number of homes that have sold in Fort Collins doing that. And then here's similar data for Greeley. The average growth in Greeley since 2010 to 2020 is 10.5% per year, according to this data. And then the number of properties sold, we peaked out in, I don't know, whatever that is, 2015 or so. And then we went down a little bit the next year and then down a lot the years after that. And so you can kind of get a feel of the number of homes sold there. Longmont, I'm going to skip, but you guys can see it. If you want to pause it on this page, go ahead. If you're watching the video. And then Loveland, similar. Loveland, 7.8% per year. And again, they sort of peaked out with their inventory around 2016. And then here's the big five city homes, like all added together. The average for all five of them combined is like 7.5% per year. And you can kind of get a feel for that there. That's all I got for this part of the presentation. Now I've got some slides from me, some charts. So I'm going to go back to my PowerPoint slide deck. Can you guys see my PowerPoint slide deck now? Like it looks different than before. Want to let me know, make sure. Okay, cool. And so I've got, I don't know how many slides, two dozen maybe at most, of just some interesting things that I found. And these are like ones that, you know, they've been emailed to me or I found them on the web or something like that. And so, and it wasn't that long. It's like, you know, maybe a week's worth of me gathering. So here's some interesting stuff. This shows you just how low the interest rates are. So you could see going all the way back to 2002, interest rates were up in the 7%, almost 8% range, and that we've been coming down pretty drastically over the last 18 years or so. And this is where we are. It's probably even a little bit lower than this now, but this is like ridiculously low interest rates. I've been telling people, I'm like, you know, property values are up, inventory is down, rents have not been going up super, super fast lately. The only thing that's making deals right now is the fact that we can borrow money so inexpensively. We're able to borrow, you know, at investor rates at like 3%. CC says going negative anytime. I don't think so. I don't think we're going to see negative interest rates personally. I just don't see it. And the guys running the Fed have come out and publicly said that. I saw a, must have been a 60 Minutes thing where the relatively early on in the COVID-19 thing, they were talking about pumping money into the economy and how they were dealing with, you know, the kind of like stimulus stuff to make sure the economy keeps going. And they basically said that they were not going to make interest rates negative. Okay. So that's my chart on mortgage interest rates. Mortgage interest rates are ridiculously low. If ever there was a time to lock in 30-year fixed rate financing, it's right now. So, you know, buy quality and plan on holding it forever. Lock in like ridiculously low interest rate debt and just hold on. All right, here is a chart showing rental apartment vacancy rates comparing downtown areas to the suburbs. So like city complexes compared to the suburbs. And you can see the vacancies in downtown have spiked compared to what we've seen in the suburbs. Okay. So you can see that we've seen a pretty big increase in the number of apartment vacancies in city areas compared to the suburbs. Suburbs have remained relatively low, and this is nationwide. It's put out by CoStar. Okay. Mary says, and what will the political situation do to interest rates? Not prediction. No idea. I really don't. I mean, like, and I'm not trying to be obtuse or difficult in any way. It's like trying to predict what will happen is really hard. It's like, and I show a chart of this where we show all these like really smart economists trying to predict what's going to happen to interest rates. But it's so hard to say. I will tell you that historically, we've used interest rates as a way to stimulate the economy and encourage transactions, because real estate starts a lot of other economic stuff happening, and people buying furniture, people buying moving companies, you know, painters and roofers and all that other stuff. And so it tends to be like a start of a lot of other economic factors. And so historically, we've used interest rates to encourage people to go out there and buy housing or refinance housing and lower their payments. And so I think that that is a tool in the toolbox that the economists and the people running the Federal Reserve Board and everything else will go out and use in order to encourage the economy to still continue going. So my guess is that interest rates will remain low until our economy starts to kind of be back running at full speed by itself. And then they'll start slowly letting off the gas pedal and raising rates to kind of balance things out. But that's my best guess, and I really don't have any clue. Rent inflation is slowing rapidly. So for those of you that have attended classes where I've talked about the consumer price index and how they take into account the share of your of the CPI index that is for housing, is they do an equivalent of the housing you're living in as rent. So if you own your own house, they have like this kind of like rent of a primary residence as a factor that shows you like what the value of your housing cost is if you were going to pay rent on it. And so they use this rent of primary residence. And this is a chart showing the U.S. Consumer pricing index, I think it's CPI, that's what it stands for, year over year, the change of the rent on the primary residence. So back in 2014, it was changing each year by about, I don't know, 2.9%. Maybe it dropped to 2.8 or so this time, but then it's slowly been increasing 3.1, you know, 3.3. At its peak, it was like, you know, almost 4% or 4% about per year change in the cost of renting your own primary residence out to yourself. That's how they kind of think about it. So it kind of was changing at 4% a year. That was kind of like the appreciation rate, so to speak, for figuring out the CPI for like the inflation rate. So that kind of peaked at 4%. Then it kind of came down here, dropped down to 3.4, increased back up to 3.9. We're seeing it now at 2.7. So for kind of calculating inflation, they're using 2.7% per year as an increase in housing costs. Okay. Mary says, thank you. Okay. So that's what it is for the rent to primary residence. Here is a comparison of that CPI cost for the regular rent inflation of the housing thing during different economic cycles. So this shows you July of 1990, March of 01, December of 07, and then February of 2020 kind of through now. And it shows you the kind of different things here. And as you can see, you know, the year over year change of CPI has been in this sort of like mid threes to mid fours range for most of the beginning of these cycles. They kind of kept it there for whatever this is, must be months or something like that. So when the economic cycle kind of hit here at month zero, they've actually seen these things start to decline. We've seen ours decline faster. So the rate of change that they're increasing the CPI index for your housing costs has gone down faster, but not as extreme as we've seen yet in these other economic cycles, you know, July 1990, March 01, 2001, and then December 2007. December 2007 was the most extreme one where it actually went to zero and bounced, maybe even a little bit negative, depending on how they drew that line there. Okay, so you can kind of get a feel for that over time here. Milford says, I've started the process of refinancing my primary residence. Okay. How can I be sure the lender I'm going with is giving me the best rate possible based on my credit score? Without starting the process with a bunch of different lenders and then pissing them all off when I don't go with them. Yeah. We have a whole 2-hour class on that. It is evaluating mortgage brokers. I think that's the name of the class. Evaluating mortgage brokers, evaluating loans. I don't remember. If someone wants to go look it up on the list of free classes or list of classes we did, I'm not sure it's free or not. But there's a whole 2-hour class on comparing and evaluating lenders where we talk about that. Short version is you're not going to do it with more than like 3, just because it's not practical to do it. And you're going to do it all in the same day because rates vary. If you call yesterday versus today, they're going to be different. And so you're going to want to go and do that. But yeah, it's tricky. And the other thing you probably want to do is get recommendations from people. You know, it probably helps if you call your real estate agent and ask them, you know, who are you recommending? And by the way, refinances are totally different creatures than purchase money mortgages. There is a bank that we use quite a bit for purchase money mortgages. And when we've used them in the past to do a refi, they were not competitive. So realize they are totally different guys. And sometimes lenders will price themselves out of doing refinances because they want to cater to home purchase people. And they will sort of like raise the rates in order to slightly discourage business and control the flow of business to themselves. So realize that happens too. All right. Housing affordability declined in August as rising prices offset lower interest rates. So this is the housing affordability index going all the way back to last August. It was at about 159. It kind of went up. I think the less affordable housing is. So it kind of like was at 164, dropped down to 161, went up to like 168, dropped down to 161, went up to like 171. And then it's been on a steady decline so that right now we are lower than we were last August as far as housing affordability, which if you think about it, property values are up. Demand for properties are up. Prices are up. Like the only thing that is making housing more affordable is all-time low interest rates. So it's just that is like the factor right now that's making everything so interesting. For those of you that are interested in new home construction, this is the National Association of Home Builders, the Home Builder Optimism Index. And it shows you that going all the way back to 2002, kind of gives you a range of how optimistic they were about selling houses, I guess. I'm not sure exactly what it's measuring, but it's a reflection of home builders and their optimism for the market. They were sort of like mid-range or so, and then kind of going into 2008, and this is an early indicator, by the way, that we were going to start seeing some declines. This was like 2006. We started seeing them become less and less optimistic because they are a leading indicator. They're like the canary in a coal mine in many ways because they are selling houses. And you could see things happening with them that gives you an idea of what's happening with the rest of the market or what will happen with the rest of the market based on their incentives and stuff, which I probably should do a whole class on that. So it basically shows you, though, that their optimism was on a pretty significant decline, a little bumped up here, went way down here, 2008, 2009, 2010. It basically, until 2012 or so, they were pretty low. And then it started rising as they were coming out of here. And we recovered to probably the 2002 level. I don't know, we're probably right around here, 2016 or so. And then it kind of went up a little bit. And then we saw this huge dip from COVID, but now it's up even higher than it was before. We're seeing their optimism higher than we've seen probably in 20 years. Home builders, they're more optimistic than ever, 20 years or so. Okay. This is the National Association of Home Builders, the expected single family home sales in the next 6 months. So similar kind of trend chart where we had 2002, and then we saw a really big decline in 2006, 2007, 2008, all the way through to 2012. Then we saw them increase the number of homes that they were expecting to sell in the 6 months. It's basically a mirror image of the last chart, except one of them is their optimism index. And this one's the number of expected single family home sales in the next 6 months. They're expecting to sell more single family homes, new construction, than they have in the last decade. Kind of crazy. Okay. Here's another interesting chart showing you the National Single Family Home Rent Index, year over year percent change broken out by different price tiers. So they're trending somewhat together. I mean, I'd say those are correlated, but there's slight differences. But basically, it shows you that going all the way back to 2005, we were seeing about 2%, you know, somewhere between 1% and maybe almost 4%, high threes, for the rent year-over-year price change. That's what this is showing. Then going into 2006, we saw those going up where they were almost at, you know, 5%-ish, somewhere in that ballpark. And then we saw them decline where rents were actually not going up as fast. Remember, this is not negative. This is like right here, it's 5% or 4% a year rent increase. Then here, it's 2% a year in 2007. And 2008, it's about 2% a year, even in 2008, where rents were increasing. Then we finally went negative probably midway through 2008 or so, maybe beginning of 2008 for some of the prices, and then into mid-2008 for other price points. And then we basically went negative where we saw a 2% rent decline in 2009, you know, about a 4% or so in the rest of 2009, 2010 sort of area. And then it went pretty quickly back up to 2011, where we're seeing about a 2% per year increase in rents. So if you've been using, you know, 2% per year as your rent appreciation, you know, based on, you know, this data for 15 years or so, that seems pretty reasonable, except for, you know, a little optimistic period here where it went up to 6 and this like worst real estate market of our lifetime where it went down to -4. But overall, looks a lot like 2 for most of this, right? Somewhere in there? I would say so. So if you're using 2%, that seems reasonable. And so right here, it shows you it's been around, you know, 2 to 3, depending on the price band, kind of went up a little bit here. The low tier increased a little faster than some of the other tiers, especially the high tier. High tier had a little bit of a decline. It didn't go negative, but it went to almost 0 for this, you know, 2016 period. And then we kind of went back to the 2% or so range. And then you saw right here, you know, this 2020 period, we've been seeing significant rent softening, where we're not seeing rents get pushed up, partially because of COVID, in my opinion. I think that COVID is causing rents to kind of stall. We haven't seen them go negative, although we've seen the high tier touch 0. These other ones, the low ones kind of are still right around 2, but these other ones are sort of like very close to 0, but slightly positive. And this is the single family home rent index. Milford says, strange that rents dropped in 2009-10, when more people lost their homes, seems like demand for rentals would have went up during that time. Yeah, except Milford, remember that there were a lot of people that were like, hey, if I can't sell my property because it's worth less than what I owe on it, I'm going to convert it to a rental. So we had a pretty significant increase in supply of rentals as well during that time. So yeah, you probably had more people looking for rentals, or they did what a lot of people did, which was they went and they bought a house before they let their credit go to crap, and then they abandoned the house they were moving out of and had a foreclosure or short sale, but they were smart enough to actually buy a new property on their way out so that they weren't renting. So there was a mix of people doing a whole bunch of different stuff, but it doesn't surprise me that we saw sort of that stuff going on. And it takes a little while for these things to kind of shake out too. Like they don't all happen instantly. You know, take a little drink of beverage. All right. So I don't know what this little, I probably should read these charts before I tell you. Low end rental prices were up 2.5% compared to high end price gains of 2%. I'm not sure what time period that was, but this chart was from October. Okay, so this is the Mortgage Bankers Association. I think that's what MBA stands for in this case. Purchase Index. And this shows you going all the way back to the 2011. It is like basically the year's worth of data, week one through week 52, and shows you a seasonal trend of the number of purchase money mortgages. It's like an index of the number of, I think it's applications, honestly, but it's an index of some sort. Number of applications for people trying to buy houses by applying for a mortgage. And so you could see, we tend to see this uptick in the springtime when people are applying for their mortgages, and then we start seeing a decline. And then by the time we get to like the holidays, you know, December, Christmas and New Year's, that's the low for the year typically that we're seeing. What was interesting about this year, which is the really bright blue line compared to all these other years where they kind of all grouped together, is you could see COVID, where we saw this massive drop in the number of people trying to get mortgages. And then we could see what happens when interest rates get really, really low and people go and they start getting crazy about doing this. And now we're seeing all-time highs going for this last decade's worth of data, where we're seeing them set new records for the number of people that are, the whatever the purchase index represents. I think it's people applying for mortgages. So it's like we're seeing this massive uptick in the number of purchase index things there. And it's like way above what we've seen historically. Okay. So this is the demand for people getting loans. And this is the same thing, the Mortgage Bankers Association, the U.S. Refinance Index showed you how many refinances are happening or whatever it is. It's the equivalent of the purchase, but for refis. And so you can see like this is the typical refi index. We've seen a pretty low period here, 2013, 2014, 2016, 2017, 2018. We saw kind of a little uptick here as rates went down probably. And then we saw a big drop off here before we saw rates like the people doing the refinances just kind of peak up here. And then we saw kind of it dip down, but it's still pretty high for the refinance index for the Mortgage Bankers Association. So kind of gives you a feel for that. By the way, do you guys like these extra charts, like beyond just the regular, Northern Colorado market stats? I tried to pick some ones that I thought were more interesting to kind of give you a feel for stuff. Yeah, so you guys sort of like that? Okay, good. Well, I'll try to do it more in the future. As an aside, well, I'll wait for you guys to do your yeses, then I'll ask you a different question because I want to get a separation of these questions so that they're distinct. Okay, so the housing boom is increasingly driven by borrowers with strong credit. So this is showing the credit score of people applying for conventional loans. And we're seeing that the people that are applying for these loans have a higher credit score than we're used to seeing. And so you can kind of get a feel for what we're seeing here. We're seeing that people that are applying for loans are having higher credit scores. So this is sort of that phenomenon. And I don't know if I have a chart coming up on this or if I've just seen it in the news. So one of the interesting things we're seeing with this particular recession is the people with higher incomes, which also correlates with higher education, we're seeing those people be affected by the recession and COVID and stuff less than the people that have lower education and lower paying jobs. And so we might kind of deduce in some ways that maybe this is an effect from that, that the people that are still have great jobs and great credit are the ones that are taking advantage of some of these loan situations and doing that. So Andrew says, yeah, big chart person. So yes. Okay, good. This chart shows the home builder optimism versus the supply of new homes. So it's that chart we saw before about the optimism. The optimism one is the blue line, and then the number of months of supply. And realize this chart is inverted, where the more months of supply is low here, and the less months of supply is high here. So this shows that we don't have a lot of supply and that they're optimistic. So we are short on supply, and the home builders are way optimistic because they're selling through and demand for these properties is still high. So that's what we're showing here in this chart. Consumer confidence by income level. Oh, I guess this is sort of what I was talking about. So this is sort of the consumer confidence by income level. So the blue line is people earning less than $50,000 and their confidence is relatively low. The people that earn between 50 and 100K are sort of in the middle. And then those that make over 100K have the most optimism right now with what's going on in the economy. Kind of an interesting study of this. U.S. housing starts monthly. So this is a super interesting chart. For those of you that are like wanting to do house hacking or nomading, where you're buying a duplex, triplex, or fourplex, and or maybe even the bigger investors that are trying to buy like, five units and above, this chart shows you how many of those are being built. So the top line here shows you the number of single family homes being built going all the way back to about probably 2005 or so. And it shows you that we were doing about 1.75 million nationally housing starts. We saw a huge decline as we hit the recession, 2007, 8, 9, somewhere in here. And then we started slowly increasing how many housing starts, single family homes we were doing. Now we had this other COVID sort of recession thing where we dropped off for a brief period of time. And now we're back up trying to meet demand, where we're building houses much, much faster. But here's the interesting thing about 5 units or more. We've been building a relatively small amount of these things, 0.25 million, so 250,000 or so, maybe a little bit higher than that, all the way into this recession. Then we dropped off considerably during the recession and then started slowly increasing again back to maybe a little bit higher than we saw before. And then we saw a dip in COVID, but now we're down again. We're not building a ton of 5-unit properties right now, and it's possible this thing could change because it's pretty erratic, right? It's got a lot of volatility. So it's possible we could see this change, but right now we're down a little bit and building 5 units or more, like kind of like apartment buildings, small apartments. But here's the interesting one. This is the number of 2 to 4 units, duplexes, triplexes, and fourplexes. And it's this really faint, very small line hugging zero. It's not quite zero because this is in millions, but it's really, really small compared to the number of single family homes and even compared to the number of 5+ units. So we're not seeing a lot of building of duplexes, triplexes, or fourplexes. So, you know, we're tending to find those ones be older inventory that have been on the market for a while. We're not seeing a lot of new construction, duplex, triplex, fourplex being built there. Okay, this chart, and I'm getting really close to the end, I think. This chart shows you the relative number of showings we've seen. So this shows you going back January through December. So each one of these lines that goes the full width is a year's worth of data. This like purple solid one, which I assume must be this guy. So the purple solid one shows 2017. You can see the number of showings per active listing that we've had. And you could see that the beginnings of the years have been a little erratic for these things with some weird trends in them. But overall, for like 2017, 2018, 2019, they've all kind of tapered off where by the time we get to August, we're seeing about 8 showings per listing or so. And they've kind of stayed similar all the way through to December. However, this year is different. This year we had COVID where we saw a real decline in the number of showings per active listing. That's when we were all like locked in place and no agent wanted to go out and show any properties. But then it really picked up and now we're setting all-time records where we're seeing more showings per active listing than we've seen the last 4 years. And it's increasing. It's actually going up where now it's like almost 11 showings or so per active listing. So the demand for properties, even looking at it from a showing basis, is actually way up. Something to be concerned about, or at least be aware of. The migration out of the urban areas. This is showing the cumulative rent changes for 30 US metropolitan areas. It shows you the cities where we're seeing rent declines versus the suburban areas where we're seeing rents sort of like stabilize around zero or so, being about the same. And this is all the way from January of 2020, right before COVID, all the way through to September. So it gives you an idea that we're seeing rents decline in cities. We're seeing rents stabilize in the suburbs. So for those of you that are buying like Severance, Greeley maybe, although Greeley is sort of like a mini core city, but probably less so. But you know, not in Fort Collins, not in Loveland, definitely not in Denver. You know, we're seeing like the outlying areas, those things being more stable suburban-ish areas than we're seeing in the core cities. Boita says, one, the stats were mostly about single family homes and condos. Are there significant differences if we spoke about 2, 3, 4-plexes? I'd almost need to go back through and think about that chart by chart. And so I don't know the answer to that. Yeah, I don't think I can generalize that much. It's possible they're all identical, that they're all exactly the same, but I don't want to speak out of turn and say they're all the same without really thinking it through. So I don't know the answer to that one. We'd have to talk about it. And John says, yeah, that's good stuff. Okay, good. Regional evictions. This is the percentage of renters likely being evicted at the end of the year. And what I want to point out to you, for those of you that are geographically impaired, this is Colorado. I think, I hope I'm not geographically impaired. This is the Colorado state right here. And so Colorado is this darker green. So it's somewhere between 4.6% and 10.1% is their estimate of the number of renters being evicted by the end of the year after like the rent moratorium or the eviction moratorium kind of like does whatever it needs to do. The US average is 15.7. So in Colorado, we're doing remarkably well. I guess that's the way to put it out there. And there are some states that are just really, really ugly. And then some states don't have data. Like, I think this is Wyoming. I don't think there's any data for that. All right. And then I think this is like the last like group of charts. So incomes have failed to keep pace with increasing home values. And I wanted to show you how this changes when we look at national data versus local data. So this is the United States chart. And it shows this is homeowners' income. It's been increasing, Must be like 2.6. This must be percentage per year or something. But it shows you like how fast they're increasing. It shows you the income is increasing a little bit more here. And it's about 2.6 or so right now is what we're seeing per year in income increase. That's how I'm reading this chart. And then right here shows you home values increasing nationwide. You know, over 4 goes up to like 7 or so, kind of dipped down here. And now it's up to like 5.8 or so. So that's what we're seeing comparatively. If we look, though, and we drill into Denver, slightly different story. So incomes have been kind of doing something a little bit different. They increased a little bit more here. Now they're on only 0.8%, but the home values increased, and they've actually not increased that much, so that they're a little bit closer with these two lines. And then here's Fort Collins. Super interesting, because the incomes for people has actually increased faster than home values for Fort Collins, at least through the later half of 2019 into the kind of COVID period that we're seeing right now. So it's kind of an interesting chart. Andrew says, is there an increasing number of income earners per household as well? I really don't know how they did this data. This is actually a chart from Zillow, but I'm not sure if Zillow generated this data. I think that they are just presenting it with the housing prices put on top of it. So I think that they're like a secondary source for this. But that's where it came from. And Andrew, if you actually need the link to it, I think I probably could refind it again, or you can just search Zillow for, you know, something with this title, and I'm sure it'll come up for you. All right, so here's the other interesting one. This is directly related. This is the share of the income spent on the mortgage, and then also the price-to-income ratio. And so you could see the share of income spent on the mortgage, about 17%, a little bit more than 17% back in 2014. It dipped down a little bit lower, you know, in the 16 or so range, kind of went back up to 17. And then in 2017, we've gotten to 18% of people's income spent on their mortgage, all the way up to 20% of their income spent on the mortgage. This is by the U.S. as a whole. And this is back in 2019 or so. Then it's been on the decline, partially because of mortgage interest rates. We've seen basically these kind of continue to decline. And right now we're at 17.5%. Now the price to income ratio is at 3.1. So that has been going up, but mortgage interest rates have made that income share of income spent on mortgage actually go down a little bit. Interesting to look at. Now this was nationwide. This is Denver. So Denver, we saw the price to income ratio dip a little bit from 20, a little bit higher than it was nationally, but it went up here to as much as 26% of people's income spent on the mortgage. But it is also down as we kind of like come, 6 months or whatever it is into COVID, down to like four, whatever this is here. This is less than 25%. And then of course the share of income spent on mortgage has now declined down to 20.6. Okay. And then here is, I'm sorry, I mixed them up. This is Fort Collins. So this is Denver. Denver basically went up here. 4.4 is the price to home ratio. And then the percentage of the income spent on mortgage is 21.8. So I apologize. I was talking about Denver when it was really Fort Collins. And this is Denver. I must have mixed up my slides. Milford says, is this pre-tax income? I have no freaking idea. I didn't do the chart. Like I wasn't involved in the actual data. And I don't think they went into their methodology. At least I didn't dig into their methodology if they did, so I really don't know. Okay. Oh, I guess I have two more slides. So if you're wondering why sellers are not selling their properties, apparently this is the reason why sellers are giving for not selling. So 31% that of the people that are considering selling within the 3 years said that they're concerned that they won't be able to find and or afford a new home. So 26% of all homeowners, but 31% of the people that were considering selling within 3 years said that. Life is too uncertain for me and or my household. About 34% felt that that was true. I anticipate a more favorable home sale price if I wait. So about 39% are not selling their property because they think that they're going to get a better deal if they wait. Isn't that interesting? I'm planning on completing a home renovation before I sell, 31%. My current financial situation is uncertain or precarious, 31%. I'm concerned about my health and or my household's health during the COVID-19 pandemic, 25%. Oops. I recently refinanced my home or mortgage, 14%. So some people are waiting because they just refied. My children or other family members have moved back in with me, 10%. And then my home is in forbearance. My mortgage payments are paused or something else, 6% there. And finally, homeowners most likely to put refi proceeds towards debt and savings. This is among homeowners citing refinancing as the reason for not selling. The share that will put these proceeds toward, 54% said they're paying off debt, 50% saying they're saving for retirement, 50% saying they're doing home improvements, 41% saying they're going to pay living expenses from that money, 33% are going to invest in stocks, bonds, or secondary property, 29% are going to use it for a major purchase, and 22% are going to pay for education, school, college, job training, whatever it is. That is all I've got for you. Any final questions? Is that helpful? For those that raised their hand, you're welcome to just type it into chat and I'll answer the questions. Thank you very much. CC says, wow, you're very welcome. Hunter says, super interesting, pretty interesting stuff from CC. Milford says, thanks so much, good info. Nathan says, yes, thank you. You guys are all very welcome. I'm glad you like stats. I like stats. Someone's got their hand up. Feel free to do that. Voita says, considering the very hot market, is it even possible wise to get accepted FHA loan on multifamily? It's hard. It is definitely hard. As I think I've told you specifically before on another class, and I meant it for everyone, but I think it was in the response to a question you asked, I said, you should be willing that if the right deal comes along for a duplex, triplex, or fourplex, for you to buy that property, if it makes sense for you to do it. But do not wait for a duplex, triplex, or fourplex. Buy a single family home, and you're not doing FHA with that when you're doing probably conventional 5% down or 3% down for your first one in some cases, or USDA if you're outside the area, or VA if you're a veteran or whatever it is. But in almost all those cases, you're probably not doing FHA. You're doing 5% down conventional, and you're going to buy a single family home unless when you're shopping during that reasonable amount of time that you've set aside where you're shopping for a house and you're ready to go, a duplex comes along that makes sense, a triplex comes along that makes sense, or a fourplex comes along that makes sense. And in those situations, you would do FHA, because we typically only do FHA for buying the multifamily properties. We're not typically doing FHA unless you really only had the 3.5% and that's all you've got, which is a different conversation we'd have. And or your credit score is low, and we need to do FHA because that's the only loan you qualify for, because they have a lower credit score for qualifying in many cases than the conventional stuff. So don't wait for the duplex, triplex, or fourplex to do an FHA loan. But it's hard because, I mean, we have a I'm not even going to go there. We've seen multiple offers on multifamily property. So for you to be competitive and be willing to make up differences and do all the stuff you need to do in order to get those and have ones where the numbers make sense, it's going to be really difficult for you to do that and be competitive with those. Is it possible you could do one? Sure. Especially for one that, you know, is not the best property that you'd want to hold in your portfolio long-term. I'd rather you buy a little bit of quality single family home than wait for a crappy duplex, triplex, or fourplex where you probably shouldn't have bought it to begin with. So Dwayne, so when, and Dwayne, I want to know if your stuff got resolved. Mary, enjoy. Many thanks. You're very welcome. Bob, fantastic presentation. Thanks, James. You guys are very welcome. Miss seeing you guys. Josh, thank you. You're very welcome. Candace, thank you very much. You're very welcome. Lynn, good stuff. You're very welcome. Mike, great stuff. Thank you. Very welcome. Jerry, is it a good time to buy a house now or not? Yes. I think it is. I personally believe you should be dollar cost averaging, dollar value averaging, however you want to look at it, but buying properties at regular intervals, whether the market is up or down or whatever. And then when interest rates go down and you have lower interest rates that you could refinance into, you ratchet your interest rate down. But right now I would buy a property and you know, be prepared to buy another property in how long it takes you to save up to buy the next one, whether that's a year or 3 years or whatever it is. I think that's a reasonable thing to do. It's part of your investment plan where you buy property. So yes, I do think it is a good time to buy a house right now. Yep. Andrew says, yep, helpful. I'm still trying to fully understand the implications from the chart on drop in inventory without a significant change in sales.
Implications from the chart on drop of inventory. Yeah, we're definitely seeing lower inventory without a significant change in sales.
Oh, you mean that chart like really early on? I don't even have the slide deck up anymore, but where I showed you now that we're basically selling the amount they get listed. Yeah, I think it's going to push prices up. I think that's what we're going to see from that. Could be other factors too, but that's my guess. Wait, it says, I mean, FHA is weaker than an offer with conventional. Totally. Yes, absolutely. FHA is a slightly weaker offer than a conventional financing offer. So if you are in a multiple offer situation where you're competing with someone else and someone's coming in with conventional 5% down, which is probably not going to happen on duplex, triplex, or fourplex because you can't do that loan. But if they're coming in with like 25% down and they're an investor doing it versus your FHA loan, yeah, your FHA loan is weaker. Definitely. Yeah. And it says, thank you, James. It was a super interesting presentation as always. Yep. You're very welcome. Thank you. Janice, it was very informative. Thank you for your time. You're very welcome. So when is the market correction? So I have a 2-hour class coming up on market corrections, but I will give you some of that right now and tell you, we don't know. You know, you could have made an argument that we thought the market was going to correct with COVID, right? I mean, if ever there was a time for a market to correct, it's when you've got people that you can't show houses, you are restricted in your ability to get out there and physically show houses in person, and people don't want to leave their property to move, and you have a whole bunch of job loss. And so maybe rents are, you know, increased vacancy, you know, and rents are not going up because you just want to keep people in place. Cause I mean, you would think that this has all the earmarks of some type of real estate market correction, but apparently there was enough, and who knows with what's going on in the stock market. I don't understand why the stock market is doing as well as it's doing with all the businesses that are struggling and some of them going out of business. Maybe it's that, you know, the businesses that make up some of these indexes are the tech companies and they're doing fine. And they're just kind of like carrying all the ones that we're seeing some carnage in. And that's very possible. I mean, I haven't looked into it to that detail, but you know, the real estate market seems to be being pushed along or pulled along by very, very low interest rates and people with a decent amount of equity because we've seen a major run up in prices. And so I don't know when there's going to be a market correction, and I don't know if we can correctly ever predict one. And so we talk about, you know, trying to do market timing. I think I talked about that during the cash flow versus appreciation class where I said, you know, are we going to try to, I taught this during the, should I wait for a real estate dip before I invest in real estate? And during that class, I tried to explain to you that it's nearly impossible to do market timing where you wait for the dip and you catch the dip correctly. And so I don't think you should try to time and play to the dip. I think you should just invest, realizing that you could be investing and have periods of time when property values go down. It's normal. It's like, you know, trying to invest in the stock market and always missing a down play in the stock market. Market goes up and down. I mean, so I think that happens with real estate stuff. And so you continue your question. I feel like you are going to answer that it doesn't matter. And yeah, that's exactly what I said. It doesn't matter. I mean, you should just invest and make sure you have really good reserves and be prepared for market declines and be prepared for what that might look like and how we kind of model it. So Asa says, I'm not sure why you don't call this the best class ever. We call the arguably the best class of the year is when we have these mini topics that Brian and I sort of like take turns. They're classes where the topics are like too important not to teach, but they're too small to be their own class. And so we throw them all together in arguably the best class of the year. And that's why we call that one. This isn't the best class ever. It's market stats. And it's not even my normal market stats class where I go and I, you know, create my own charts. I just use somebody else's charts. So I hope you guys like the other charts. I didn't have to do it. Jerry says, are you worried about collecting rent with people losing their jobs from COVID? I personally am not. I have amazing reserves, I guess is the best way to say it. And so, no, I'm not personally worried about if that happens and we have to evict somebody or they have to stay in the property for a little bit of time before we're able to get them out or we give them cash for keys or whatever it is there. And I have not personally experienced that. I don't manage my own properties. Property manager does. But no, I think that's just a normal part of planning is that you've got to expect you're going to have bumps in the road. You're going to have a tenant that's, you know, stops paying rent or does damage to a property or they lose their job and they've got to be evicted or they refuse to leave. I mean, these are just normal parts of just business, period. So no, I'm not really worried about it at all. It's going to happen. What is the latest ruling on evictions? I don't know the answer to that. I know Brian typically kind of keeps up on some of those rules. I honestly let the property manager do this. I don't keep track on the eviction rulings or anything like that. I'm not involved at that level. And so like between me and the tenant is Tammy, then the property manager, then the tenant. So I don't even get like the direct interaction from the property manager. Tammy sort of is the in-between for those things. So I am getting like a tier up level management. I'm not in that level of detail. So I apologize, Brian. Brian probably is much more knowledgeable about that because he does some direct management for some stuff. So Steve says, a two-hour class on something you don't know. Ha, 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 ha. I'm not sure what that is. I don't know what that was referenced to, but yep. And then great class, James. Thanks. Yeah, Tammy is a rock star. I agree with you. Tammy is amazing. I like her so much. I married her. So if I missed your question or something like that, if you got a hand up, please go ahead and ask your question. I don't call on people to do that. I'll put your hand down. But if you have a question I missed for some reason, please do let me know. I didn't intend to deliberately miss anyone's question. I intended to answer them all. And thank you for hanging out and sticking around for any questions you may have about this stuff. I've been thinking, I haven't done a stats class like this probably in a little while. I usually do them at the beginning of the year, but they put them out quarterly through Your Castle. I almost wonder if I should do these more frequently, even if they're a little shorter. Maybe I do like an abridged one, like a little hour one or something like that. So I don't know. If you guys want to see those, let me know or suggest more frequent market stats class or something. Jerry says, is it better to pay cash in full for one house or split it up and purchase two? That is a really nuanced question because it really depends on what you're trying to achieve and what your goals are and what your risk tolerance is and probably what your other financial stuff is all about. So I am between Brian and I, and Brian's not here to defend himself, so it's unfortunate, but between Brian and I am probably more on the side of free and clear properties than Brian is. Brian is correct mathematically that your returns get amplified both ways, whether it's good or bad. If they go against you, if property values go down and rents go down, stuff like that, then it gets amplified that way as well. Although it's buoyed by depreciation benefit and debt pay down, the return is buoyed by that. It's kind of held up. It's supported even when you have declines in appreciation and declines in rents. But Brian tends to be more of a, at least some leverage. I don't know if he would advocate, you know, extreme leverage. He's a pretty prudent guy as far as that goes. And I hate talking about him when he's not here, but I will tell you, we disagree on this. He's a little bit more debt friendly. I'm a little bit more free and clear friendly, but it's not from a numbers perspective. He is right. I mean, the returns are better if you are leveraged, even if you're 2-to-1 leverage, like you're talking about, like, you know, splitting it up between, you know, half down on one and buying two properties that way. And if you're going to do that, in some ways with debt levels where they are today, unless the cash flow is significantly worse, and by worse, I mean negative probably, or you need the cash flow because you're retiring or something like that. And this is why this is highly nuanced. I probably would do like the 75% loan to value, put 25% down and keep a good part of that in reserves instead of putting, you know, 50% down on two properties or something. So it's really, there's a lot of detail and a lot that goes into thinking about this, but my general guideline for you is, well, I don't even know if I have a general guideline. It really depends a lot on a lot of stuff. So I don't know. I guess that's where I was going to say. Sorry, Jerry. Sorry, I couldn't answer your question more, but it does matter. Thanks, James. You're the man. Be back soon. You're very welcome, Luke. Thanks. Hunter says, thank you, James. Awesome class. I would like more frequent classes like this for sure. Okay, I'll kind of put it on the list of things. Maybe do more of these. Purchase two. Yeah, Mary says purchase two. I guess you're talking to Jerry. And Steve says two, absolutely. Yeah. Chris says, you mentioned you can't depreciate property because of income cutoffs. Since you are a real estate professional, doesn't that remove that rule? I don't do my own taxes. My understanding is it does not, but I don't, and maybe I'm wrong. Maybe it is being depreciated. I'm not looking at my taxes at that level either. You know, Tammy is, so, but she's not home, right? I'd call into the next room and ask her what the deal is, but she's working out right now. So I don't think so. I think that we're way above it and it's just getting delayed. There is no like limits on the like Something does happen when you are a real estate professional, but I didn't think it removed the income cap, one part of that, but I could be wrong. If there's any CPAs or accountants on the call and I'm wrong, let me know. Jerry says, love this class. Thank you. You're very welcome. It's tax losses is what CC says. Yeah. Again, that's not my area of expertise. I am a layman when it comes to taxes. This is not my area of expertise, not my specialty at all. So sorry, but maybe Chris, why don't you just reach out to your accountant or your CPA and just verify with them. I'm sure it'll be like a 5-minute phone call. They can tell you exactly what the deal is for you. Cool. Well, that's all I got then. It's 8 o'clock. Thank you all for coming on. I am probably not going to hang out afterward. I'm probably going to either wait for Tammy to come home and get some ice cream. Maybe I'll go in the hot tub, get a little hot tub action in tonight. So maybe I'll go do that. But thank you all for coming on. Skylar, you're very welcome. Glad you guys all enjoyed the class. I will try to post the recording up and do that. And I will try to also post the PDF. I don't think it'll happen until tomorrow at least, but maybe I'll drop you an email tomorrow for those of you that are on the list. Nothing else I got for you. You're very welcome. Dwayne, did they get that taken care of for you? The call I had with you a couple weeks ago? They fix it all for you? Yep. Okay, good. Awesome. I'm glad to hear that. All right. Yeah, CeCe, thank you. You're very welcome. Enjoy my hot tub and ice cream. I will enjoy my hot tub and ice cream. All right, guys. Have a great night. I appreciate it. I will talk to you all next time. Thanks again. Bye-bye for now.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Nomad Real Estate Investing Podcast, produced by James Orr Real Estate Services in conjunction with the Northern Colorado Real Estate Investor Group. Help others find what you're already enjoying by leaving us a rating and review on Apple Podcasts. For additional information, please visit us at jamesorr.com. For questions, suggestions, or other feedback, please email us at jores@jamesorr.com.